Okay, should be recording. I should have cleared my throat before I did
I love this, that. But... Literally, what a way to start the fucking podcast. Stop, stop. No, okay. No, I'm so glad.
I'm just gonna have to do some breathing. So I feel like with this episode, we definitely have to start with a disclaimer.
Yep.
We are going to be discussing some R-rated. Is it R-rated or X-rated?
Well, see, when you say it like that, all the aunties are going to gather at this episode and say, do you know what? Sharam. No Sharam.
Aunties, if you're here, episode one I made from my heart just for you. This one, not so much.
Yeah, it's a bit more of a psychoanalysis of taboo things, let's say.
So I definitely, just to give everyone an overview of what we're going to be talking about, mind-body connection, it's super popular right now. A lot of people are diving into spirituality and kind of moving away from the traditional religious aspect of spirituality and kind of just focusing on the mind-body connection. And so tying that into the adult entertainment industry, we're just going to be psychoanalyzing that a little bit. And not in the sense that, you know, not in the sense that Call Her Daddy psychoanalyzes these things. That's not what we're trying to do at all. Like Call Her Daddy, I feel like that podcast is a little bit more explicit, and what we're trying to do is a little bit more sophisticated. And so some of the criticisms of Call Her Daddy are kind of that it's a little bit rooted in misogyny, in the sense that this podcast kind of focuses on quote unquote empowering women, but I don't find that hypersexualizing women really is empowering. What do you think?
I completely agree with you. I think we were discussing this prior to recording, and I just think in the comment that you made about how the very, you know, phrase Call Her Daddy, on the surface it sounds very empowering and it's like, yeah, go women, take control, put the big boy pants on. But when you actually listen to these podcasts, I think a very important point that you made at the start was, you know, it kind of uses things like, I think, gaslighting you mentioned, and manipulation, and kind of, again, hypersexualization. Using a woman should essentially use her body and sexualize herself to one up on men. And that's a very dangerous sort of philosophy to convey to your female audience, because you're essentially saying to one up on men and to wear the big boy pants, essentially, you have to sexualize yourself. And that is very far from the truth. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on that as well.
It's kind of like a power trip, I find. Like, even the name of the podcast, Call Her Daddy, like that mention of daddy, the implication that whoever is the daddy holds the power in the relationship. And like you mentioned, there's a little excerpt from an article I'm just going to read where someone else is discussing their issue with this podcast. And they basically say that their issue lies in the language used regarding women and sex throughout Call Her Daddy, and the repeated encouragement to engage in toxic behaviors like gaslighting your partner if you're caught cheating, knowing your quote-unquote rank as a woman on a scale of 1 to 10. And there's been mentions of, like, you know, if you're on the lower end of the scale, your sexual performance has to make up for those points that you're missing, which is kind of just like, you know, it's 2021. We're here to empower women. We're not here to tell women that you need to have sex to empower yourselves. It's not valid, in my opinion.
Absolutely, 100%. I just think there's so many other things you could say. When I first heard the phrase Call Her Daddy, I was so excited, because I've listened to a couple of her, you know, shows, and I don't know if you're familiar with it, Sonia, but they're like an hour long. So it's a bit of a chunk to dig your teeth into. But when you get into it, you know, I was expecting some tips on, like, female empowerment, how to, like, boost your ego in a non-sexual way, albeit, you know, the title is sexual in nature. But, you know, she's steered it in a very specific direction, again, towards hypersexualization and how to compensate for her subjective rating on, you know, how a woman should behave in society. If you're lacking in certain areas, you need to compensate by being oversexual, and that's how you gain back some sort of power and get some leverage on men. But again, that's not exactly the safest sort of philosophy to convey to your audience, especially impressionable young women, who I imagine are the majority of this this podcast's audience, you know?
Right, like it kind of takes the informal girl talk and kind of puts it out there for the public to see. And I feel like that's where the problems come in with this podcast, in the sense that there are a lot of young girls who are listening to this just to know like what to do, what to expect, how to act, how to be like the best. And it's a little bit problematic. So we're kind of steering away from that entire dynamic and kind of just focusing on the psychological aspects of the adult entertainment industry. And, you know, we're just going to stick to that. So hopefully we didn't lose you there. So to start off, I think it's important to lay the foundations of the mind-body connection. And I'm sure, you know, we're both psychologists, as one would like to say, and we have roots in psychology, philosophy, all the good stuff. So I just wanted to introduce the mind-body dualism philosophy. And so there's a few aspects to this. I would say there's four main, I guess, schools of thought, you could put it. And so the first would be that the mind and body are separate entities. And so basically what that means is the mind is separate from the body. It can exist without the body. It kind of leads directly into the more religious view that, you know, you have a soul, your soul can separate, it lives on once your physical body dies. And then it's the next view is kind of the complete opposite, where it's the mind and body are connected in a way that they cannot be separated. So in this sense, the mind is kind of dependent on the body. And I used to resonate with this view deeply, just because, as you know, in psychology, we see that, you know, certain aspects of the brain, certain centers of the brain not working properly or sending messages to the right places, it kind of has the potential to diminish your consciousness in a way that, you know, you're not who you were had those areas been working in the way that they're supposed to. And one example I like to use with this philosophy is, for example, the effects of drugs and alcohol. So we know that your consciousness and your behavior and everything, should you take these substances, it does diminish, change, influence, alter your consciousness in a way. And so the next two philosophies kind of lie in between both of these, that one, the first one is just the mind exists. So your they're just completely disregarding the physical. What you perceive is only real because you have a body and a mind to do that. And then there's the opposite, where it's just the body. So your mind does not exist without your body at all. They're not interrelated entities. It's just your body and it's just your mind. So I'm curious to know which one of those resonates with you the most.
In terms of the things that you've mentioned, I think, like you said, we both come from psychological backgrounds. And I think for me, when I consider the mind-body relationship, if there is one at all, because a lot of people don't believe it, I'm sure you're familiar with Richard Dawson and his views on the mind and the body, and, you know,
he's going to elaborate on that a little bit more for anyone who's not familiar, if you can.
So Richard Dawson, I remember learning about him. He was one of the very first he's a philosopher. I'll give him credit where it's due. He's very, you know, renowned all across the world, so I will give him that credit. He was one of the first philosophers I actually learned about in year 12 in my A-level philosophy class. And from what I do remember, and there's probably a lot of Richard Dawson fanatics out there that probably know a lot more than me, but from what I remember, he's very not of the opinion that anything that is not physical, that is part of this physical world, it simply does not exist.
Right.
A lot of people might resonate with that. You know, like you said, one of the examples was the mind is just, there's no interrelation there. It doesn't exist. It's, you have a brain, you have a body. Of course they will interact, but the mind, the soul, nothing of the sort is actually real. And that's essentially Dawson's philosophy.
So where would you place yourself on the spectrum?
I think, so obviously we've both been raised in, around, you know, the religion of Islam, and that in of itself has a very large philosophy focusing on mind and body relationship. Any religion, I think, has a lot to say about the mind-body connection and the relationship. Religion aside, we're both from psychology backgrounds, and I think the one fundamental aspect that they teach you in this discipline is that there's always a collaboration between the mind and the body, whether it be the mind or the brain. Those two terms are always interchangeable when it comes to psychology, I think. You know, I mean, even the module that I was learning this term, brain and behavior, and trying to establish brain and behavior relationships, I've learned so much within that, you know, itself. And I just think, I'm definitely of the view that they both exist, but I think there is a constant collaboration and a very strong relationship between the two, which is why people are the way they are. You know, the body affects the brain, or the mind in this sense. And, you know, likewise, the mind will affect the body. They have a very strong relationship, and I don't think either should be dismissed or rejected when it comes to philosophical debates, because the interaction itself is what makes us all individuals, really, like separates us from one another. Our experiences shape the brain, but in turn the brain shapes the body, and likewise, you know. Exactly. What do you think?
I definitely agree, because we, for example, let's take mental illness. We know that in terms of your environment, that can affect the way that your illnesses are expressed, but also we know that there's heritable aspects of, for example, depression. If you have a family history of depression, it's more likely to be expressed in your genes. So it's not going to be an issue of, you know, your life could be absolutely fantastic and you're going to struggle with being depressed because you have that genetic history of a disorder. So it kind of shows how the body influences the mind. And then if you look at it from the other end of the spectrum, your mind and the environment that your mind has been placed in, that also affects expression of mental illness. And that's just one example. I find another way that this has been popularized lately has been through Dr. Joe Dispenza. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he has an amazing story where basically he used to do some kind of sports. I think he was a racer. I don't know if it was a bike or a car. I can't remember right now. But he basically went and competed in a tournament and ended up having a horrible, horrible collision mid-race. And, you know, it was absolutely horrible. The doctors told him, like, you're probably never going to be able to walk again, type of thing. And so this man essentially used the power of his mind to heal his body. And now he writes books, teaches workshops, essentially goes around the world explaining how basically his philosophy is that your brain does not know the difference between you seeing something and you experiencing something. And so there's a few examples of this, in the sense that I'll give a few experiments that have been done in psychology. So some brain imaging research has shown that if you imagine a threat, the same brain regions that light up when you're experiencing a threat light up when you imagine this threat. So that kind of opens a window into understanding PTSD and things like that, and how, you know, you just imagining, thinking about something, your brain is reacting in a way as if you were actually doing that. And there's another experiment where a little bit more visual, where volunteers were asked to play a simple sequence of piano notes each day for 5 days. and they basically had their brains scanned while they were doing this. And another set of volunteers were asked to just imagine playing the notes. And they also had their brains recorded each day. And so what was interesting about this one was that the changes in the brains of those who imagined playing the piano were the same as those who actually played the piano. And this is interesting because Dr. Dispenza has done studies where they've told people, patients, to imagine working out or exercising their hands. And then they've actually had a group of people who are, you know, physically working out and exercising their hands. And they found even the muscles in these people's fingers, even in the group that was simply imagining working out, were actually changing in a way that was making them stronger and almost exactly the same as those who were actually exercising. So it kind of shows how powerful that mind-body connection really is. What do you think about that?
100%. Like, that is so trippy to me that you don't even have to interact physically with a concept for your brain to conjure up the sensations and experience, like what the experience itself would feel like. That, don't you think that's crazy that the brain is able to conjure up something like that, give you the same sensation to emulate that without you having to even interact with your environment? That's very, that in itself, like, should be evidentiary of how powerful the brain is and how significant the mind-body relationship is.
And so in terms of trying to explain this, I find one of the ways I can explain it is mirror neurons. So you're probably familiar with mirror neurons, but for those of you listening who are not familiar with mirror neurons, basically I'll go into how we discovered mirror neurons. We did a bunch of experiments on monkeys, and we basically found that when this monkey was reaching and grasping for an object, the same brain areas were lighting up as if the monkey was himself reaching for the object. So him imagining or seeing a visual representation of someone else reaching for the object basically lit up the same areas as if he was doing it himself. And so that kind of pushed researchers to think, okay, if this is happening in primates, maybe this is happening in us as well. And they tested this out, found that it was absolutely true, that even as humans, when we watch something happening and we do something, the exact same brain areas are lighting up. And so that's where the mirror name essentially comes from. Did you guys go over that when you were studying psychology at all?
I think we touched on it in A-level psychology, but as you know, Sonia, from this past week, my degree modules are not necessarily psychological in nature, right. Which is why we haven't actually touched on it as part of the degree, but I do recall coming into contact with mirror neurons and the concept of it, I think at A-level with biopsychology, because that's a big concept in psychology, you know, and it talks a lot about synchronization and, you know, how it's used to justify imitative behaviors. So that's a very big phenomenon in psychology. I just don't think it's explored as much because it's biological in nature, but it has a lot of implications for psychology, as you just mentioned.
For sure. It kind of explains why we get like sweaty palms when we're watching people do stunts, or, you know, our body reacts when we're watching a horror movie. And then it kind of explains the adult entertainment industry as well, and how that's so popular, because when you think about it in this way, that, you know, when you're watching adult entertainment, your body is reacting in a way as if you were yourself engaging in that in sex. So it kind of makes you understand where the obsession with this industry is kind of coming from.
Yeah, 100%. I think we've touched on this before in our many conversations, that, you know, there's a line, I think, that many people don't realize that they're crossing when it comes to the adult entertainment industry in regards to taboos. And, you know, I think that really speaks to what you're saying about being able to experience the sensations by just by watching things like this. And that obviously is not necessarily a good thing. Yeah, it's not necessarily a good thing to be able to sensation seeking via watching these sort of videos. I think, you know, and I think I discussed this with you before, but there's, despite it having a lot of psychological implications in the social sciences realm, pornography addiction has not actually been systematically investigated. I think that's crazy, don't you think?
That's so interesting to me. I would think that it's been looked into quite a lot, because I feel like human sexuality has kind of become a field of research on its own. I took a human sexuality class in uni, and it was very interesting. It was taught by a very gay man, which was amazing, but it didn't really go much into pornography at all, which is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I was very surprised, because the amount of times that, not even, of course, it's explicit in nature, but the implications of it, you know, you don't have to outwardly do, social sciences doesn't say we're discussing pornography in the sense that the taboo parts of it, you know, it's not always in psychology. I think there's this misconception for a lot of people, even people studying it, that psychology is all about studying the taboo, the atypical aspects of human behavior, but it's not. You have to learn about what typifies human behavior to understand where disorders come up and where addiction starts. And in the realm of the adult entertainment industry, I think you could gain a lot of meaningful findings and correlations just by researching why does addiction even start with pornography. It's not, because when you think of addiction, you think of drugs, you think of, you know, things like that. But, you know, to be addicted to pornography, that's a very interesting phenomenon. I think it really needs to be fleshed out in much more detail by psychologists.
And it's a very real thing, I find, especially with this generation growing up on the internet. You've had access to this, you know, quote unquote adult entertainment, but how adult is it really if kids have been watching it since they're like 8, 9, 10 years old?
100%. Oh, it's so overused. And it's not even necessarily, you know, when I say adult entertainment, I mean, I know what that directly refers to. Society is very, and I really don't mean to sound like a nun here, but I kind of am. Society is very hypersexualized. Like the media, there's game shows that I've heard of that literally broadcast male genitalia, where women look at the genitalia individually and pick out a partner on that very basis. Like, on literal national television. Like, that is, you know how accessible pornographic things are to younger, to adolescent, like underage people. You know, it's not necessarily googling, you know, direct pornographic video. Like, it's everywhere. Sex is everywhere. Like, there's no way you can protect, I hate to say it, and it might sound a bit cynical, but there's no way you can protect, you know, young people from not viewing it, because it is quite literally everywhere. The media has very much exploited that area. What do you think of that?
I agree. I feel like you don't have to go out looking for it, which is the crazy thing, because you'd think that in order to find something so explicit, you'd have to go out down into the deep rabbit holes of the internet to find this stuff, but you don't. I find even a lot of children's movies, or like, you know, for example, Marvel and stuff like that, there's definitely explicit scenes in those movies, and in like superhero movies, child related movies. And if there's not like that level of explicit scenes, the subconscious priming is there, because the themes are still there, whether they're explicitly showing it or not.
100%, I agree. I agree with that.
So I did find this one forensic psychologist from Boston, his name's Joseph Plod, I believe. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but we'll just go with that. And he's a clinical forensic psychologist who studies the effects of pornography. So basically, he found that when people look at sexual imagery or videos, what's going on in your brain is dopamine is filling your brain regions and causing those intense feelings of pleasure, which kind of explains the addictive aspect of it. Because when you're doing drugs or, you know, I feel like with addiction, it's important to note that anything can trigger these dopamine responses. It doesn't have to be a drug. It doesn't have to be alcohol. It could literally be a person. You could get addicted to someone's company in a sense, because if it releases as much dopamine as necessary to get you feeling hooked, that's all that really matters. It's pretty much just the pain, pleasure, reward system that's getting activated when you're watching this kind of thing. What do you think?
Addiction is very much synonymized with these very big and bad drugs and like all this stuff, but really the reality really comes down to dopamine. Everything is dopaminergic, man. Like, honestly, I remember having this conversation with my friend and she sent me an article saying men, like a man that you're attracted to when you're in conversation with them, they can quite literally have a massive impact on the amount of dopamine your brain releases. So quite literally, the reason crushes and, you know, like things like this, I hate to be that reductionist person, but it really comes down to your dopaminergic activity. You know, that thrill you get from, you know, when your crush pops up to you and like you're talking and it's like you can't get enough of them. It quite literally is the sensation of not being able to get enough of them and their company and their attention, because they're what, you know, is influencing the release of these high levels of dopamine in your brain.
Exactly, you're so right. And it kind of highlights how, you know, even sugar addiction, dopamine, it's all connected, and these neurotransmitters, they really do influence our behavior in unimaginable ways.
100%.
And so that kind of leads me into like the taboo part of the adult entertainment industry. Like, I'm sure most people watching or listening are familiar with like the taboo part of this, in the sense that you're not just watching, you know, a husband and a wife having a lovely, you know, interaction. Like, very rarely is that what people are going to go and watch. It's more so the thing that has caused me to think about this is like the sibling and the family taboos and how popular those are, and the cheating ones. Like, people who claim to never cheat or would never cheat are very much into watching this kind of dynamic going on, and it really grosses me out. I hate to say it, but it does. Like the sibling family ones, because I always think, what is the appeal with this? Like, no one is watching this and thinking of their sibling or of their mom and dad or anything, like, or their step parent. They're not doing that, so why is it so popular?
Honestly, Sonia, I think it comes down to shock value, and I think people enjoy a safe space for the, and we all get them. You know, whether we enjoy them or not, it is part of human nature to have intrusive and thoughts of impulsivity. And most of the time, you know, they're impulsive in, you know, the way they are in nature. They're taboo. And I think humans really enjoy the idea of having a safe space to sort of navigate these taboo intrusive thoughts. Not that you necessarily fantasize about a family member or anything of the sort, but it's the adult entertainment industry has sort of become a safe space for people to not act on. I hope not, Jesus. But like, that's nasty. But like, in the sense to sort of navigate these taboo thoughts. And I think, you know, when, and these videos that you're talking about, they're actually the most top rated on these websites, you know. That these are the taboo ones get the most views. And it really makes you think, like, if you're not gonna act on it yourself. But then it makes me think what you just mentioned at the start of the podcast, that you don't necessarily have to be emulating or physically engaging in these behaviors to actually receive the, lack of a better word, you know, the pleasure that you get from like watching it. And that's really interesting to me, because if you wouldn't act on it, maybe that's what makes it a safe space. Like, I'm not gonna act on it, but I'm gonna watch it because this is my safe space to act out in my brain. And maybe you attain the same pleasure as you would in, you know, acting it out.
Yeah, I agree. And that kind of leads me into the more taboo kinks, for example, CNC and BDSM. So for those of you who aren't familiar with that, consensual, non-consensual, which is very, very taboo in society to do that or to even admit to be into that. But if you look at statistics, those categories are very, very, very popular. And it definitely leads me to the point that you mentioned about how having a safe space to act out these fantasies kind of, it makes your brain feel good at the end of the day. That's what I'm gathering from the research.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know if you knew this, Sonia, but actually CNC, that whole that realm is actually the top rated search for women.
Right, right, which is so crazy because, you know, you see that in contrast to like Me Too movements. Obviously, we do not like being non-consensually messed around with, but BNC, yeah, on the other hand, it's, again, like you said, one of the most popular categories for women. And so that kind of leads me into something else that Dr. Joseph said, where he kind of associated the addiction and the taboo by saying that over time, people come to associate these images, videos, and he calls them reinforcers. So they begin to associate these images with pleasurable feelings. However, if that response gets triggered over and over and over, you need a bigger hit of reinforcement to get that response. And it's the same thing with addiction. Like if you're, for example, drinking alcohol, you take like 3 shots of vodka every day at night. And over time, that 3 shots is gonna turn to 4, it's gonna turn to 5, it's gonna turn to 6, because your body is adjusting to how much dopamine it's essentially getting from what you're watching or what you're doing. So it definitely makes sense that these taboo type of kinks have come about from people just, you know, indulging in the norm, you know, the normal stuff so much that it's just not exciting anymore.
Yeah, and you have to go the extra mile every single time. What's crazy to me is that, and I know this is entirely feasible, not that I'm, you know, that I personally know of any people, but if you go on Reddit, you see so many people discussing things like this. But I think a bigger concern is at what point do you say, okay, maybe I am addicted, maybe I'm overdoing it? Because at some point, you know, no matter how taboo the category is that you're searching up, it's not going to cut it for you. You're going to end up potentially doing something quite damaging. And I know that's quite a controversial thing to say, because not everybody necessarily will engage with this, but it happens. You know, you're saying you're building up this tolerance almost to very taboo, inappropriate things. You know, I mean, we're just talking about family categories and CNC categories, but there are actual categories out there, you know, that convey a lot more, let's say, illegal things. And, you know, the dark web, for those who are familiar with it, you know, that it's comprised of a lot of these illegal things that, and I think that's where it comes from. People have built such a high tolerance that they're now resorting to extreme measures like going on the dark web to satiate themselves. And that, bro, that's not healthy. Like, I don't care what it is, like whether it's porn, whether it's drugs, nothing should take you to that extreme measure. You know, it should never be that way.
Right. And so just the final point I have written from Joseph, basically he says that the more, and this is a direct quote, he says, the more you do and the greater degree of access, the more explicit it is, that you seem to need more and more and more, which like kind of bangs on the nail with what we've been saying, that, you know, the more you watch, the more you're into it, the more you're enjoying yourself, the more you're going to do it and the more extreme you're going to be in your viewing habits and preferences, should we say.
Yeah, a euphemism, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so another really interesting study I found, which was a little bit scary to read, actually. This is actually quite old, for lack of, you know, new studies going on. This is a 2014 study from...
That's a very interesting point to me, simply because it's one of the most recent things I've learned in psychology, how adolescents are the most predisposed to risk-taking behavior. And that risk-taking proclivity could come from anywhere. It could come from driving 100 miles per hour, drinking underage, doing drugs, and in this regard, maybe even exposing yourself or overexposing yourself to pornography. And having that predisposition at such a young adolescent age, it's like we said, you know, it's available everywhere. Like, there's not anyone who, unfortunately, I don't think you can protect young adolescents from things like this, especially if they've been proven to have a risk-taking proclivity as it is at their age.
Right.
You know, the combination that you have there, your brain is quite literally at that age collaborating with risk-taking proclivity within your environment. That can't amount to a lot of good stuff, you know?
I'm just curious, do you know whether, like, hypersexuality is considered a risk-taking behavior? I think it is.
I think... Do you know what? Not that I can back this up with any research, which I typically do, but I will just go on a whim here and say, I think it is. I agree with you. Hypersexuality is, it has a lot of implications, let's say. Like, anything hyper has a lot of implications.
Right. That makes sense. It does make sense.
It's like advocating for, like, young people to have, like, safe sex and stuff like that, because I think, you know, even in, like, just secondary school learning and high school learning, like, you learn a lot about, like, the risks of, like, sex and, like, hypersexuality, and of course that is very much real in existence. So, you know what, I'll end on my note saying stay safe, kids. It's a big bad world out there.
I find ultimately, like you said, you can't stop people from doing what they want to do. So what's the next best thing? It's just educating, right? And hopefully, listening to this podcast, it can at least, it can instigate some self-reflection, maybe, for people who might be struggling or might be wondering, like, oh, why do I enjoy watching this so much? Like, now at least you have a bit of a clue as to why you might be hooked on what you're hooked on.
Yeah, and I think, like, we started this podcast, you know, with a few words to say about Call Her Daddy, and I think she's got, you know, she's acclaimed for a reason, and I think that's because she touches on topics that not a lot of people do. But I think in the same regard, we have done the same thing, but just not in a way that is as help me out here, Sonia, as, for lack of a better word, you know.
I think one of the things, it's I feel like these type of taboo categories, they definitely, if you've dived into them, you've definitely had one of those moments where you're like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, what does this say about me? You know, like, if I, like, why am I enjoying watching this? And I'm hoping that at least through listening to this podcast, you can associate the fact that, you know, your dopamine responses are what are pushing you to do these things in a way, and not, you know, not questioning your moral compass as much, because I find you don't watch these things or you don't enjoy these things because you're secretly a psychopath or you're secretly, like, a sociopath and you just haven't realized it yet. There's more going on than that.
I think, and again, it ultimately does come down to your, you know, your mind or brain body relationship. You, again, as Sonia reiterates, you know, you are not a psychopath for investigating these sort of areas. I think the human brain is naturally very curious. When someone tells you not to talk about things or things that are outwardly not appropriate to discuss in a social setting, you're just, I don't know what is wrong with our race, but we're just inclined, we're even more drawn to it. And I think that's the beauty of it in some regard, like, not beauty, sorry, that was an awful word to use, but just in that's where the curiosity sort of peaks for us as humans. It's like, oh, it's new, it's niche, it's like so unusual, I need to investigate it. And I think that needs to be fleshed out in social science research as well, like, what is the association here that we have, the curiosity thing and the dopamine thing, like, do they link, are they interrelated? But again, the mind body thing, like, that we were talking about, you should always, you know, like, it's good that we've instigated a topic here and we've brought to people's attention that it's okay to, you know, how do I put this? You're basically not a psychopath.
It's okay to explore these things.
Like, you should just don't go overboard with it. Of course, explore, you know, inform yourself, educate yourself. Do you know what I mean? This is obviously just, this is a podcast and it's only going to instigate thoughts for you, but it's very important to do your research on these things and what it means for your health, physical and mental. We're living in very, very difficult times right now. And, you know, there's a lot of instances where we might not be getting the most out of our education right now. So if we've piqued your curiosity in this regard, hopefully it will allow you guys to educate yourself just a little bit more on what you're taking in and what you're consuming on a daily basis, and, you know, just stay healthy, stay safe.
For lack of a better pun, coming to terms with what you I have to give you credit for that one, because that pun was for you.
Oh, funny girl. That was, I think when she said to me, girl, I want you on my podcast, and I was like, you know what, that's fantastic. And we were obviously discussing a lot of things within this conversation as well, and I remember just saying to her, it should be called Coming to Terms, because I know exactly what we're going to talk about, because we have a lot of strong views on it, clearly. And it's just fitting, you know what I mean?
It really is. And I love it too, because coming to terms in this time as well, specifically pandemic days, lockdown days, we are starved of physical interaction. Mm-hmm. Even looking at someone like 2 feet away, 6 feet, whatever it is, I haven't left my house, so I don't know. It's just, we are all so starved of any affection, any physical interaction. So I feel like it's important to touch on this topic right now.
Yeah, we are at serious risk of being desensitized to a lot of things that we've discussed today, which is why it's important to raise attention on it. Because when you don't have that human contact, I don't care how introverted you are. Me and Sonia are both introverted to some degree, but honestly, human interaction, we do thrive off it. Whether you notice it or not, we do. We do need it to survive. And when we're deprived of that, you know, not by will, but when we are deprived of it, it really does have its implications on our brain and what we consume. So again, stay safe.
Stay safe. And, you know, just as a finishing point, like we said, be mindful of what you're watching. And, you know, that's not just tied to the adult entertainment industry. Be mindful of everything that you're subjecting your brain to, because in one way or another, it is going to have an effect, and it is going to manifest in certain ways that you probably might not expect. So stay safe, and thank you, Noor, for joining me today. I really appreciate you doing that and being so open and vulnerable to discuss such a taboo topic.
Of course, man. Thank you for having me. It's, you know, it's been a long time coming, and I just want to say now, like, I'm extremely proud of Sonia for going ahead with this vision she's had, because she has a lot of interesting views on so many topics like this. And we're very early on in the stages of her podcast manifestation. And I just can't wait to see what you do with it in the future. And yeah, I'm just so proud of you, bro.
Thank you. And, you know, like, we'd love to hear back on you, your thoughts, listening in, anyone who's listening, like, you all have valuable opinions as well. And so if you do want to send us a message, our Instagram is at the Arts of Release podcast. It's mainly where I've been promoting anyway. So I'll link it in the Spotify as well. And you guys feel free to shoot us a message. Just comment your opinions, what you thought, what we can improve on, what other topics you guys want us to dive into. Because at the end of the day, this is for you just as much as it is for us as well.
Absolutely.
So on that note, good night, everyone.